coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back. On this week's Worth Doing Badly, we will survey the lessons for the sixth Sunday of Easter. And they are Acts 17 verses 16 to 31, Psalm 66 verses 8 to 20, 1 Peter 3 verses 13 to 22, and the Gospel according to John chapter 14 verses 15 to 21. This is the lesson we'll begin with, and here is David Weber.
This text has moving parts that, to me, Ethan, make it difficult to know how they relate to each other. So it begins with a interesting and controversial connection between loving Jesus and keeping his commandments. And later on, Jesus will say that loving him means keeping his word, expanding the term a little bit. But the connection between love and command is problematic because everybody knows that you cannot command someone to love you. That wouldn't be love. That would be something else. And yet here we have love connected to command. And so I make sense of this, recognizing that Jesus is defining love as a linguistic rather than an emotional connection. It's a linguistic connection that is established primarily through listening, which is synonymous with keeping. Keeping gives this listening a kind of a sense that to keep Christ's commandments is to value these words, as in the words of the Psalm, more precious than gold and sweeter than honey. So commands, when Jesus connects loving and commands are not these obligatory impositions on our life. There is something about the commands that are consistent with love. And we do know that Jesus's definition of love connected to listening is recognized as insightful, that when one loves another person, one listens attentively. And that's what our relationship with Christ's word is, that our love for Christ is expressed in our attention to his word, because in our experience, it satisfies our desire to know the truth. The truth is this second moving thing apart. When the first one is the connection between loving and command, and then secondly, that in loving God, Christ's word, it is a love for the truth, and particularly the truth about the way that we relate to God. Now, this is really autobiographical, but I like the commands, even though I don't like being commanded. I like the connection of love to commands because I know that in order for me to love and be loved, there has to be a radical dethroning of my fat, relentless ego. That's Iris Murdoch's view, that this is the center of life, that this fat, relentless ego is constantly unsatisfied and constantly wanting attention. And in order for a person to love and be loved, that ego has to be what she called as unselfed or dethroned. So to me, that is a truth that I easily forget. And the command to love, to me, it recognizes that the joy of loving and being loved totally depends upon becoming de-self-centered, which to me, more often than not, that sounds like a promise rather than a prohibition, that this can happen, and it happens by or within or when it happens by valuing or listening or keeping Christ's commands. Does that make any sense?
I'm still processing it and not exactly sure what to say, but I'm trying to connect this. We had a Bible study last night. We're going through the Gospel of Matthew, and in chapter 16 and 17, you see this challenge from the Pharisees and the Sadducees that runs right into Peter's confession of who Jesus is, which goes right into a passion prediction and then goes into the transfiguration. And the transfiguration sort of sits, you know, of course, we're right here on the verge of the ascension. But the transfiguration sits as this, you know, this capstone, this ability to see the glory of God is like the high point of this whole narrative for the three disciples. And how does it end? They see God's glory reflected, and Moses and Elijah are there, right? The law and the prophets. And then God says, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him."
Of course, the liturgy repeatedly comes to that same thing with singing the Sanctus, which is Isaiah's, Isaiah becoming deep self-centered in the presence of God, you know, in the holy, 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 and Isaiah recognizing that if the focus of his attention on him, he says, "Hoy ve," that I am undone. In other words, I'm falling apart, that my egocentric self can't hold life together.
Then it's like the competition of the glories, right? Our egoistic, self-centered glory versus the glory of God.
Yeah. So there becomes a wonderful point that I have to come to over and over again when we actually want the self to be, as in the baptismal language, drowned. And we'll get to that in the last reading, that the drowning is not bad news. It is the thing we've always desired, because our deepest desire is to love and be loved. And that is impossible if the ego is at the heart and center of our lives. So, this decentering of the ego, continues, to all who love God and continue in the hearing and keeping of Christ's words. And then now the third moving part, the indwelling of the Spirit of truth. So, in this sense, this isn't, the command is something which actually opens up a brand new vista of intimacy with God, where God is on the outside. But now we have this early promise in anticipating the Pentecost, where God will dwell in us, and God's function, the Spirit's function, will be to encourage us, or to keep us in the truth. So the Spirit dwells within to continually teach us the truth. And the truth that's actually expressed by John is, because Jesus lives, we too live. So easily said, but the Spirit is given because that is a truth that is just going to slip through our fingers continually, that the resurrection is an established historical fact. Jesus lives, never to die again. All right. We so easily say that, which means then that I'm just going to repeat myself, that we too live and live eternally. But there must be all sorts of reasons and experiences that undermine that, that stop us from believing that and living that. So Christ promises us the Spirit. So the truth that Jesus lives means that we have twice experienced the gift of life. And I know when I experience the gift of life, I don't have to be commanded to be grateful. It happens automatically. And here we are doubly gifted with life. First, for an appreciation of our biological lives that come to an end. But then, because of the resurrection, we are gifted with eternal life, which follows then that there is a spontaneous and natural sense of gratitude in coming to understand that truth. And when the Spirit repeatedly brings us to the truth about that we are the recipients of the double recipients of the gift of life, praise follows.
I think it leads us nicely into the psalm, because you have this whole latter half of the psalm is about offering our praises and thanksgiving to God.
We're overcoming a long history, perhaps 200 years a continual argument against God's command shaping our lives. And yet when John sees the command, it is not something to escape. It is something to love and to enter into. It has almost a Jewish sense of Torah, that this is wisdom and life. And so obviously there's a wrong use of commands, a command in which it subjugates people rather than liberates them. But in this sense, the command, even the command to worship, may sound obligatory. It certainly sounded that way when I was a child and wished to do anything but go to church. But when you have the experience that it opens up into a vista, a way of living that we would have never expected, you begin to think that the commands are, in fact, something to be kept, because they do, in fact, have a value that lasts longer than gold and is sweeter than honey. So it's possible then, in this, all the moving parts have been established, that it is possible to love Christ by loving his word. And the loving of his word, it happens with this indwelling of the Spirit teaching us the truth about life. So when we get to the psalm and the other readings, what I think that they say is that it really does take for us to be tested by trial, that we have to become sick of our fat and satiable ego, that if God's love is taken as a license to not listen to his word, then that sets loose the fat and satiable ego, and that means being damned to despair. The psalm actually extols the maybe not the beauty, but the virtue of being tested. For you tested us, God. You refined us as silver refined. That's beautiful in a way, but it's also terrifying, because there's a lot of heat involved with refining silver. And Jesus taught us to pray not to be put to the test. But then he did say that if we are put to the test, then we should be praying to be delivered from evil. So again, I'm tying it back to what I might have to repent of. But the testing and refining is required to repeatedly dethrone our egos, to crucify the old man, to drown the sinful self. So Christ in his love subjects us to the trials of fire and water. The trials are pretty clearly articulated here by being trapped in a net with heavy cords around our loins, and where others ride over us. Now, that is some testing. And it's then when we are downtrodden, the psalm seems to say, then our desire for God is expressed not because it's commanded, but as a spontaneous cry for mercy, a spontaneous cry for deliverance from the depths of despair.
We're carried then right into the house of God. So we've been tried, and then there's this shift. Yet you have brought us out to a place of abundance. I will come into your house with burnt offerings. So despite the trials and the tribulations and the testing, where do we find that mercy? Is in God's house, where we can receive the fruits of his sacrifice and then offer our sacrifices in return, and know that he's listening. You know, God listens to the one who is listening to him.
We think that the burning is going to destroy, but the whole image of refinement is the burning actually reveals what's worth, what's worthwhile, what has value. So hard to remember when the heat's turned up in our lives and God tests us. So we go into Acts, and there's a lot of testing going on, particularly because Paul is working out the philosophical implications of the resurrection. If the truth is Jesus rose from the dead, what does that actually mean for mortals? for reasons not reported, Paul was discussing the resurrection with enlightened representatives of two competing philosophies of the time, Stoicism and Epicureanism. The Epicureans thought that the good life was, that in order to have the good life, you needed to be distracted from life's badness by maximizing pleasure. So in other words, the good life was only a temporary good. It was a qualified good. It wasn't good for everybody. It was probably only good for limited people. There was none of this Catholic sense that the good life is, Catholic small c sense, was a universal promise that Christ makes. It's not for some people. It's for all people who suffer from sin, and that's from everyone. And so the Epicureans thought the good life was if you had enough money and leisure time to maximize pleasure. The Stoics thought the good life wasn't really all that good. It was just a life in which you rise above the all too real badness. And the Stoics were more, well, Stoic, I guess, and about the fact that if life was good, it wouldn't end in death. Life has some good in it, but the Stoics were always the kind of people that they would see some good, and then they would say, yeah, but it's not going to last, or it's not as good as it appears, or it's not tomorrow, it won't be as good as it is today. So if I wasn't a Christian, I am not sure. I think I would probably tend to be Epicurean, an Epicurean, and try to distract myself from life badness. But both philosophies agree. Paul bakes both these philosophies in the same pie. They have the same despair, and the despair is expressed, you only live once. And that life will be largely disappointing. So, this is why, after Paul questioned the premises of Stoicism and empiricism, he was, which is kind of funny, he was dismissed as a show-off mystic babbler. Now, that, if you're going to dismiss somebody, calling him a show-off mystic babbler is a really good way. I wouldn't mind being called that. And then after they had called Paul this, something strange happened. Their ridicule became interested in the resurrection, especially when he began to see that Paul was treating the resurrection not as a myth, but as a historical fact. And that the historical fact had the meaning of it was that the resurrection was a down payment on our own resurrection. That Paul, being very well read, being very articulate, believed that there was a real resurrection that would rescue him from this life, that Paul was under no obligation to be an Epicurean or a Stoic. He was free from those because of this ridiculous doctrine of the resurrection, which the more Paul talked, the less ridiculous it seemed. So the truth that he spoke began to take hold, so his listeners could imagine an existence where death was rendered irrelevant and life would go on then eternally. But the one thing needful for living this good life would be neither Epicurean distraction nor Stoic discipline. The one thing needful for the human desire for life to continue eternally was not some myth or religious practice. But yet Paul said, in your myths and in your religious practice, he asked essentially the question, what do you desire? What are you hankering for? What do these things say? And then Paul connects the dots and says, it's that you want life eternally. And the selfish ego's relentless and greedy hunt for pleasure or for this restless preparation for pain cannot be called a good life. It is a life that is just existing. It isn't truly living. It's not a living. It's not really a life that bursts out in praise of gratitude. It's a life that you endure. And so Paul says, if God has given assurance to all by raising Jesus from the dead, this is where Paul hits it. He has, God has given assurance in the resurrection that having the good life would come as a gift and not by some clever Epicurean lust for pleasure or by this gritty life of the Stoic. It would come as a gift and would not require our distractions or our discipline. It would be simply given to us, like our created life, our saved life would be the same kind of gift. When eternal, living eternally became a real possibility, for these people, then it made sense. Paul's words made sense that all people everywhere would desire to get started with living by first repenting. Now, I think that there is a subtle energy that gets picked up when you have worked on something, but you don't articulate it in the sermon, that knowing that, in the ancient world, Stoicism and Epicureanism were dominant philosophies. You don't have to say it. You don't have to give the history. And yet you begin to recognize that the adherents of those philosophies were largely disappointed by them. And I can say people come to disappointment, but if I know something about these philosophies, I can actually intellectually feel that disappointment and recognize, oh, and now I can see how, as that had happened in the epistle, and now I can see how people would see Christ's commands as inviting rather than prohibitive.
Especially since Stoicism and Epicureanism are sort of making a comeback right now. There are a lot of people who are buying into that and living their lives according to those philosophies. So it's quite relevant even still today, yeah, to have that awareness as we're preaching.
What a great setup for 1 Peter, because Peter says, always be prepared to give an explanation to anyone who asks you for the reason of your hope. Always be prepared. And again, I have admitted my fault. Peter is not saying go out, get into arguments and try to beat people into submission. And in fact, what we find that both Peter and Paul, their preparation to carry on a discussion. And this is where conversion takes place. It is not a one-off thing. It is maintaining a conversation over a large arc of time, which means that you have to be truthful, but not needlessly offensive. And I have made this mistake. My enthusiasm for argument has gone over the top. And I've said things that stop discussion. Peter says, your preparation should treat the other person with reverence and dignity. He actually uses the word for meekness, the blessedness of meekness, which is, the wise capacity to read situations, the subtlety of situations. And so, and here's what I like about this, that the reason why people will have questions is that they will recognize that Christ gives a hope that the world does not give. So as I continually remind myself, the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre makes the beautiful point that when people are thinking, they are doing three things. And one of the first things that they do is ask questions. And this is what I like. If our sermons are generating thinking, there will be, after the service, there will be real questions, not fake questions. And the other two categories are that real thinking will create disagreement. And we get that in, first off, in the epistle, or rather in the Acts reading, that Paul is, first of all, met with disagreement. And the third one, which is harder to see, is that that people will want to know the distinctions, like the distinction between love and command. So here, Peter says, Yeah, no, this gospel stuff is interesting. And that's not just an assertion. If it's actually interesting, you will find people with real questions. So running through the ministry of Peter and Paul was this preparedness to initiate and sustain conversation, knowing that over the arc of time, this gift of hope generated by Christ's resurrection would eventually get the attention of the hopeless. And the hopeless is not just some people. Hopelessness is what it means. That is the condition of living in the shadow of death. So the hopeless are depicted as drowning in the despair of their own making. And the text almost imagines that those drowning were like those drowning at the time of the ark. But the difference is that the ark there is not reminding them of their despair, but the ark represents the offer of salvation, that those who recognize they are drowning are given entrance into the ark. So this is the hope, which is for Peter, this hope is most brilliantly exemplified in baptism, in the truth of baptism. And this is why, in the gospel, I see that the drowning of the fat and satiable ego, this is where I get it, that baptism promises a kind of drowning, but a drowning that gives life. It's a promise that if you somehow could die before you die, dying at the end of life would not have any effect. It would be just simply a passage through to eternal life. So the question is there a way of killing the ego without killing oneself? Am I only my selfishness, or is there a self that God has created and redeemed that is capable of transcending selfishness, of getting beyond it? And that would require, first of all, despairing of oneself, of seeing oneself and saying, this is it. This is what I'm stuck with. This is who I am forever. And then recognizing that in baptism, Christ offers us an alternative to rescue us. And he essentially says, grab hold. And that command is not lifeless. That command is actually life-giving. It's not an obligation. It's a path to life. So the truth of Christ's word becomes evident. And that truth is that this word is a gift, even when it comes to us as a command. It's a gift that is essentially consistent with his promise of indwelling love, and a love that gives us life, and a life that we ourselves, when we come to value it, will express this sense of appreciation that his word is more precious than gold and sweeter than honey in the way that we come together in worship.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Go to the App Store or Google Play and get the one that is right for you for free. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other programs on our schedule, write me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. David and I will be back next week at this same time. Stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.